Fasten your seatbelts and turn up your radio. We're going on a road trip.
If the river runs dry, so do the clouds in the sky. San Barnum drift away. All I need to get me through that cloudy day. If ever I do die, I know I'll be on river time. Thunder clouds to come, but orange sun still keeps the shine.
Wisconsin is home to more than 13,000 miles of streams, thick with trout and other game fish caught on the fly. From the spring creeks of the Driftless area to the Freestone rivers of central and northern Wisconsin and the Great Lake tributaries, there is something truly special about wading in the cool waters of the state, surrounded by tall, majestic pines and deep blue skies, watching deer, eagles, and other forest creatures in their natural setting. Welcome to Route 51. I'm Shereen Seewert. Wisconsin is a haven for both novice and experienced fly fishers who challenge themselves to achieve the perfect combination of fly selection, fly placement, and drift. It's a sport that takes you to places you would never normally go, following rivers to parts of the wild that only the river can take you. Fly fishing takes practice, time to get the feel of the rod and line swinging overhead and the perfect arc. It takes careful studying of the river, contemplating each choice carefully, and it can be frustrating, especially in the beginning. But for those who have mastered the art, landing a trout on a dry fly is one of the best feelings in the world. Today, we welcome two guests to explore the lure of fly fishing and what makes Wisconsin the perfect place to enjoy it. Heidi Oberstadt, Trout Unlimited Diversity Initiative Coordinator for Wisconsin and the Upper Midwest, is with us today. Heidi, thank you so much for being here.
You're so welcome.
Also joining us is Dan Perkins. Dan is a former professor of communication at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire, also a former fly fishing guide and an all-around fly fishing enthusiast. Dan, welcome to Route 51.
Well, thank you so much, and welcome. Thank you very much, both of you.
Your questions are welcome, too, and we'd love to hear about your experiences. Join the conversation by calling us at 800-780-9742 or emailing us at route51@wpr.org. Heidi, let's start with you. How long have you been fly fishing, and how did you get started?
It's a great question and kind of a winding road to get there. I've been fly fishing for about 10 years. And I actually started by being involved with Trout Unlimited first for several years. I'm a commercial photographer and a communication consultant. And one of the members of my local Trout Unlimited chapter knew about my photography work. And he asked if I'd be willing to help them, the chapter, document their stream work, their kind of before, during, and after situation. And I was like, oh, that's really interesting. I don't know anything about that. What are they restoring? What was it? What's it supposed to be? And so it was really interesting hanging out with all of the Trout Unlimited folks and watching them do this work and their work with the DNR. And, you know, I gave them all these photos and I was really like, wow, what are you guys going to do with this? This is like a really amazing thing that you're doing. How are you going to tell people about it? And it turned out they needed a little bit of help with publicity as well. So I got them started with a new website and a Facebook page. And as a thank you for my work, they gave me a fly rod and a scholarship to their fly fishing school. And I'll never forget this picture at their banquet when they gave me this fly rod because I was holding it wrong because I knew so little about it. I'd been in the chapter for like a year at this point, and I didn't even know what to do with it. And I went to their fly fishing school, and it was really a life-changing thing. I mean, fly fishing has changed the trajectory of my life and helped me find out who I am as a person. So that's how I got into it.
Wonderful. Dan, what about you? How did you get started, and what drew you to fly fishing?
It's a family thing for me. I'm one of five siblings in the Perkins family, and our father was very much a fly fisher. Back in the late 1930s, he helped teach a gentleman who became one of the premier fly tiers in this country, a man named William F. Blades. He's from Chicago. And he happened to be vacationing in Spooner and saw my dad headed off to go fishing. And this man asked my dad if he could give him some lessons, and he did. My dad found out he could teach somebody else. So at about age 10 or 12, each of the five of us got lessons. That was our birthday present. And to this day, the three of us siblings still extant, fly fish, we just do. It's something you learned very early, but as Heidi already noted, you keep learning. There's always something taking place, but that it's a long, long history. I've been doing this for 70 years.
Wow. Well, I'm curious what makes a good trout habitat. What do they need, not just to survive, but to flourish and multiply in Wisconsin's rivers and streams? What is it, Heidi, that makes that great trout habitat?
Sure. Well, the single most important thing for trout is the water temperature. Trout need cold water to survive. They really thrive when the water temperature is under 65 degrees. And that colder water the colder temperature allows that water to hold more oxygen, which is so important. So part of that good habitat and that cold water is that streams that are forested, when they have plants, that riparian vegetation along the stream, that's really key to help shade the water and help keep it cool. It also helps prevent erosion. And as I'm sure you can imagine, when a stream suffers from erosion, it gets wider. So it gets wider, it gets shallower, and that water warms up. So that vegetation is really a key component. It also helps filter pollutants out of the water and then provides shelter for those fish and other aquatic organisms that help make a healthy ecosystem.
So what is it about Wisconsin's trout system that makes it different from other areas of the country, like fly fishing in Montana or Colorado, for example? Dan, what's the difference in Wisconsin?
I think it's merely the case that we have much less publicity. I have chatted with people at the fly fishing shop in, say, Casper, Wyoming, and they were from Minnesota and some Minneapolis, St. Paul area, and they were not aware of the trout streams in western Wisconsin, like the Kinney or the Rush or the Ogallee. They didn't even know about that, and they were 90 miles away. They were going off to Wyoming to fish. And personally, I think that's great. I don't want everybody to know about the good fishing we've got in Wisconsin.
Exactly. Yeah, that is interesting that that people that close by had no idea of the magic that was just right around the corner, really. And I understand there are different classes of streams. Heidi, do you know about that? How are the streams classified?
Yeah, so class one trout streams are the best. I actually wanted to add something. So Dan, I think I've been at that fly shop in Casper. I'm pretty sure I've been there when I was in Wyoming. I think they have two, but I went to both. So either way. But one of the things, so Dan was talking about, Western Wisconsin and those special streams. We have an area here called the Driftless, and it is super special for trout anglers. I mean, it's special in general because it's beautiful. And the reason that it's called the Driftless, for those of you guys who don't know, is because it escaped a glaciation. And so that sediment that was in the glaciers that they would deposit as they passed through is called drift. And so that's why that area is called the Driftless. And it's not just Wisconsin. It's about 24,000 square miles. And so it's in like western, southwestern Wisconsin and southeastern Minnesota and northeastern Iowa and northwestern Illinois. So it's kind of in the corner of those states. And there's over 6,000 miles of cold streams there, like trout streams in that area. And so that's one of the largest collections of streams anywhere. So Dan is right. That is like the gem of Wisconsin trout fishing. And it is really interesting that a lot of people don't know about it.
That is interesting. So it goes from a class one to what a class is. What's the other end of the spectrum, Heidi?
I think that might be three. Dan, do you know?
I think it is three now, but there may be an additional fourth, which has a whole different kind of classification. It started out with five, thanks to Wisconsin TU a number of years ago, and thanks very much for the Wisconsin DNR establishing the trout stamp system. Money started to come in and flow in, and DNR people, fish management, were working with trout chapters all over the state, trying to find out about the streams in each of the various areas. And they took that information very seriously and came up with what was the first categorization. My recollection is there were five. They're now down to three, but exactly for the reason Heidi suggested, the quality of the water, the temperature, and the clarity. Wisconsin DNR has done a fabulous job in getting access to streams and protecting them with, as she already mentioned, the vegetation. I'm 20 minutes away from supper. I live in the middle of Eau Claire, and I can drive my house out to Elk Creek, catch supper, and come home in an hour because of Elk Creek, which is right on the border between Dunn County and Eau Claire and Chippewa counties. And it's there because the Wisconsin DNR has listened very carefully and taken the advice of the TU chapters in this state.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because, I mean, climate change, of course, is a big, big topic. And scientists say climate change is having a direct impact on water temperature. So I guess what kind of effect is that having on the natural trout habitat in Wisconsin, and what's being done to address it? Dan, what do you know about that?
I don't really know anything about that anymore. I used to be quite involved with TU. I'm not anymore. And I used to be quite involved with the Wisconsin DNR. I hear some reports of some streams in that driftless area Heidi just mentioned, which parenthetically starts about 30 miles west of where I'm sitting. That's where the driftless begins. The DNR is finding some, I would say, older species of brook trout in some of the small streams on the edge of the driftless, and they are working very quickly to help those streams get back to their original state so they can protect those unique fish. But it's a constant problem in this area because much of what is on the ground is residue from the rivers, and it's what I call sugar sand. So the streams change constantly. Early spring rains on this Elk Creek where I fish here. First time I go out in the spring, I have to walk up and down the stream and see where the holes are and see what has changed, because just the natural water flow over the winter before the spring rains come shifts that sand around in the stream. And it's the nature of these particular streams right where I am. You get into the driftless, it's much harder ground and not that kind of change, but the DNR is managing that kind of thing.
Well, I'd like to ask both of you about your favorite place to fish here. Do you have a favorite spot? Heidi, you mentioned the driftless area. Is that it for you, or what's the very best place to fish in Wisconsin?
Oh, that's like an unfair question. There are so many great places to fish. I mean, the driftless area is very special if you love trout. It's possible that you can go down there, even in peak trout season, and find a stream where there's nobody else fishing. It's like you're by yourself because there are so many hundreds of miles of fabulous trout streams. And it's just like a special place. You know, for me, I get in the car for a couple hours and it's like I'm in a different area. There's hills and valleys. I live in the Central Sands, speaking of sand, Dan. So it's just very different. But of course, my home water, which is the Tomorrow River, will always hold a special place in my heart. That's the place for me. You know, it's just 20 minutes away. And I've spent a lot of time there just reflecting and growing as a person. So it's not just about the fish. It's about the birds and the plants and the act of being in the water and finding that special place where you have no cell service so you can just really unplug.
Oh yeah, not being wired up when you're out there. I would imagine that is magical. Dan, what about you? I know you don't want to give up your secret spots, but what is your favorite place to fish in Wisconsin?
Similar to Heidi, that's an extremely difficult question. I've been fortunate to be able to fish in 48 of 50 states and most of the Canadian provinces and Pacific and Atlantic and in Gulf of Mexico. And the thing is, the joy for me is usually who I'm there with. And it is companionship, although quite often when you go trout fishing with somebody and fly fishing, you get to the stream, they go one way, you go another. But it still is company. I find that most enjoyable, and that can be anywhere. I've been fortunate enough to catch all kinds of species on the fly, and it's anywhere. I'll be sure. Extremely egotistical. Anywhere I am, it's got to be nice. So that's a good place to go.
You're listening to Dan Perkins and Heidi Oberstadt, our guests today on Route 51, for a discussion on fly fishing in Wisconsin and what makes it so unique. When we return, we'll talk about some of the best places to fish in the area, some more of those, and some tips for beginners as well. Your questions for our guests are welcome. Join us by calling 800-780-9742 or email route51@wpr.org. I'm Shereen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm going fishing, that's what I'll do. Think about nothing, not even you. Catch a real big one, a big speckled trout. Snapping in the water, I'll pull him on out.
He called it shadow casting, keeping his line above water long enough and low enough to make a rainbow rise. And I realized that in the time I was away, my brother had become an artist.
We're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. That was a clip from A River Runs Through It, a 1992 film that spoke to the magic of fly fishing as a merger between spirituality and science, the soul and nature. Heidi Oberstadt and Dan Perkins are here today as we continue our exploration of fly fishing in our area and what makes the sport so unique. We'd like to hear about your experiences too, and your questions are welcome. Email us at route51@wpr.org or join us by phone. The number to call, 800-780-9742. Before we talk about the technique behind fly fishing, I wanted to circle back about stream restoration for just a moment, Heidi. You wanted to add some clarification about the trout stamp. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, so those of you who get a fishing license here in Wisconsin, you probably have seen an option for an inland trout stamp on your license. And it's a $10 add-on that you need if you're going to be fishing for trout. And that money actually goes into a special fund that just goes for trout management in Wisconsin. And the DNR focuses on surveys and stream restoration projects to help take care of and increase the trout population. And that was one of the most interesting things about working with Trout Unlimited, is watching the way that Trout Unlimited and the DNR work together on these projects. So Trout Unlimited provides manpower. I mean, sometimes we have work days where people are coming out in their waders and they're pulling out invasive weeds and they're installing different types of stream bank strengthening options. And sometimes it's fundraising, and we help fundraise for projects on our home waters to make sure that the DNR can get those projects done.
Thank you. That is interesting, that how the two groups work together to keep this going. Dan,
one thing to mention before you go on, I'm sorry, sure. This is just very very honest of me as a fly angler. So the surveys that the DNR does, they do shocking, and it doesn't actually hurt the fish, but it brings the fish out and they count them and they measure them. And they actually get a relatively accurate population count in a stream section of what types of fish are in there. And it's funny because the first time I went to witness this, I was like, you guys, there's not really that many fish in here. And of course, you know, the DNR folks pulled out a couple hundred trout. And I was like, oh, maybe I should work on my technique. There are a lot of fish in here. It was very humbling.
Wow. I had no idea. I guess you just never really know when you're looking at a stream what you're going to find in there. So that's interesting. Dan, take me back to the very first time you caught a fish, that moment when the trout grabbed the fly and you felt the line tense between your fingers. Take me back to that. What did you feel? What does it feel like?
Yeah, that's really conscious and interesting memory. My first trout actually was not on a fly. It was on a worm, but it was, I was only 10 years old, and I remember that fish. I remember it fighting. I didn't know what it was. I remember it when I finally got it up. It was a little brook trout, and Brook trout is really char. They're salmonoid, so they're, you know, beautiful colors and gorgeous. But I was 10 years old. First fly fishing experience was probably 3 years later, actually catching one on a fly at Beaver Brook, which is southeast of Spooner, Wisconsin. And that was 3 miles from my house in Spooner. And my dad took my brother and I out there. We walked out there. We didn't have a car back in the 50s. And I learned fly fishing on the stream, which was different from the fly fishing I'd been learning from my dad, which is fly fishing in the front yard.
Okay.
To see that fly float along, and all of a sudden, the subtlest, the tiniest kind of vertical motion from under the water, and that fly disappeared. And I looked at it. My dad said, set the hook, set the hook. And by the time I reacted, the fish had dropped the hook and gone on. And I didn't catch that first fish. That's what made it all the more magic. Life is not 100% success. So let's try that again. And my dad stood there and coached me a little bit. And within another few minutes or another few casts, I finally had a trout on a dry fly on a fly rod, and it went in the fry pan. And
okay.
It was, I recall, very tasty. That was a magical moment. Both.
Well, it just goes to show that sometimes the magic is in the trying, right? Not always in the catching. Hi, Heidi, how about you? Do you remember the first fish you ever caught?
I not only do I remember the first fish that I ever caught, my husband was there and took a photo of it, and it's up in my office. And it was on the last day of fly fishing school. So I was with some more experienced Trout Unlimited members from my chapter. And it was a tiny little brook trout, about 5 inches. And in the picture, I'm holding my rod in one hand and I've got my other hand up on my cheek, like in disbelief at this fish, because I'm a very girly person. And this brook trout came out with these pink polka dots on her. And I was just in awe at how pretty she was. These pink polka dots with these little blue halos around them. And I was afraid to touch her because I didn't want to hurt her because she was little. I was going to put her back. And that moment is just like captured. It's on the wall in my office. It was so special. I could not believe how beautiful our native brook trout are.
That is a great story too. I want to ask you now to take me through the whole experience. Before I even set foot near a stream, what kind of equipment do you need to get started? What's the bare bones if I'm going to learn how to do this? What do I need, Dan, to pack in my bag?
Oh, if you're talking about learning, my approach to learning is in my front yard or in one of the local parks. And what I bring is usually a 3-foot-long, 3/8-inch dowel rod and a piece of old yarn, which is tied on there. And the first test is whether or not you can use an old stiff dowel rod and a piece of real flexible yarn and learn how to cast that. Then we can move on to the real equipment, rod, reel, line. And all of a sudden it just opens up with dozens of different choices at each level. How long a rod? What weight of line will you cast? How long will that line be? Will it be a double taper? Or will it be a weight forward? And how long will your leader? All those incredible choices open up after, when I do this, after I get you to be able to understand the physics of this. Physics, to me, are the absolute basis of fly fishing. If you don't understand friction and levers and fulcrums, I bore the heck out of you making sure that you understand what it is you're going to do. Because then when you pick up the rod, you understand where your fulcrum is, and you can cast your line much more efficiently than if you don't. So, long answer, but it's a very complex and ongoing challenge to everybody.
Heidi, how do you choose which type of rod you need, which weight? Which, I mean, it seems very complicated to a beginner. How do you choose?
Sure. There are a lot of different types of rods that we measure them in weight. And the smaller the number, the lighter weight they are. So, for example, my most common rod is a 3-weight, which is a very lightweight rod, but but I'm often fishing on trout streams that are just a couple feet wide. If I'm going fishing for a smallmouth, I might use my 7 or my 8 weight rod instead. And the different types of line that you use and the different types of leader that you attach to the line and the different type of tippet that you attach to the leader all depend on what you want that fly to do at the end of the line and what type of fish that you're fishing with. So Dan was right on the money when he talked about practicing, you know, with a dowel and a piece of string. When I was first learning, I took my oldest fly line out there and I would go practice in the street in front of my house. I didn't have a big yard. So I had this old line and I was whipping it in the street. I'm sure my neighbors thought I was crazy. But one of the things that fly fishing is known for is that beautiful looping line that you see. And the reason that fly fishing looks like that compared with traditional fishing is because our fly often weighs nothing. When you're fishing with a worm or some type of a lure, you know, you hit the button on your rod and you toss it in the water and the weight of that worm or that lure pulls the line out of your rod. When you're fly fishing, the fly weighs nothing. So you actually have to learn to cast the line itself and how you transfer that energy to get the fly and the line to do what you want. That's kind of where the magic lies. And it does take quite a bit of practice. And I will say, I mean, I'm sure Dan will agree with me. Despite all of the years of practice, you still get your fly and your line caught in trees and in plants and in grasses. And right when you know there's a giant fish right up there, 15 feet in front of you, and you want to get there, you get your fly stuck in the tree right above it. And there's no way to get it out without scaring the fish. I mean, this is a part of fly fishing. Am I right, Dan? Isn't this it?
Absolutely. A friend of mine, he's a social psychiatrist, said it's all about potential reward. It's an anticipation and reward. That's what fly fishing is, anticipation and reward. And even the slightest reward keeps you coming back.
So, Heidi, as complicated as it is, and I mean, what do you say to beginners who might be frustrated with the difficulty level they find when they start out? I mean, casting a fly line, very different than casting with a spinning or a bait casting rod. So what do you say to those people as they're struggling through those first few tries?
Well, there are a lot of really great books and resources that you can use, but there's honestly nothing better than having someone show you one-on-one, hands-on what to do. There are a lot of great classes that you can take, many of which are low in cost or free of charge. Trout Unlimited has classes. Many chapters have their own. Orvis has one-on-one courses that you can take. And for the women out there, there's the Wisconsin Women's Fly Fishing Clinics, which are a very amazing program taught by women for women. And that's actually been put on by the Southern Wisconsin chapter of TU and Tina Murray. And so that's the best way to learn, honestly. You can get really frustrated really easily when you're with other people, but it's easier, I think, when you're trying to look at a picture of what you're supposed to do and your line's not doing what you want. Having a person show you and demonstrate for you and give you real-time feedback on your form, that's the easiest way to learn, in my opinion.
Dan, you talked about how you're constantly learning new things, and as a fishing enthusiast, no matter how many years you've been doing it, there's always something new to learn. But how do you learn to read the water? Fish live in all sorts of different spots on a river or lake. And if you don't recognize those places, you can wind up spending a lot of time fishing spots that don't hold any fish. So, I mean, Dan, what do you look for?
Well, water movement, I mean, it's pretty simple to find out where fish hide, especially on trout streams, because of the nature of that beast and their need of flowing water. So you look for certain kinds of swirls and V's when the water comes across two stones and then makes a nice big V. There's a half dozen different kinds of things that you could find. There's probably an app for it these days. But you look on the internet and you'll find all kinds of examples of how to read the water. But as I said, the real key in Wisconsin, our waters shift all the time. So learning that particular skill that you thought you had last year when you're fishing a particular stream, you need the skill of vision rather than the skill of understanding exactly where they're going to be, because they're not going to be in the same place each year. And it just changes all the time, but that's part of the joy of it. That you're actually hunting these fish and trying to find out where they are hiding this year. And it's not extremely difficult, but the main difficulty that I found with people trying to learn, that was your question for her a few minutes ago, how do you get through the initial frustrations? You just take your time, and I've never found any problem. I've taught to you classes also, and just with some over-the-shoulder work and some patience, most people who get that sense, get the feel of what it is that's happening to their body while they are casting, will stay with it. It is constantly referred to and compared to learning how to do Tai Chi. The motions are very, very similar, and they have the same kind of effects on the body. Once you're really focused on fly fishing, you can't think of anything else. All your troubles melt away, and you just focus on one kind of thing. It's very comforting, very relaxing, just to do as Heidi said, go out in the street and just cast, get that cast rhythm in your body, and the world melts away around you. It's quite magical.
I think when many people envision fishing, the picture that comes to mind is someone sitting in a boat, casting a line. And it seems like fly fishing has taken kind of a backseat to other forms of fishing. Heidi, is that a good thing, or would you like to see that change?
Oh, I wish that everybody had a chance to try out fly fishing. It's such a peaceful activity. It's so quiet. I love how involved I feel with the ecosystem when I'm there. You know, we're talking about trying to figure out where the trout are living, where they're hiding, what they're eating, what life stage that bug is in. Like really knowing the water and figuring out, okay, what worms are in here right now? Is this in a larval stage of this fly, or is it hatching and is it coming out with wings? And trying to figure out how to kind of trick that trout. You have to feel like you're a part of it. You're not just sitting on top of the water, you're in it. You're in the water. And when I talked about this, like this magic, you know, to my friends when I was in my 20s, they were like, okay, wait, you're standing in the water in rubber pants. And I was like, well, actually they're kind of like a technical material, but sort of, yeah. You really have to try it, I think, before you can really understand how special it feels. You really do become a part of nature. You're in it.
It seems like you become one with the water.
May I interject something?
Absolutely.
A number of years ago here at UW-Eau Claire, there was an exchange with a Chinese professor who was going to start teaching Chinese language here. And that summer, on the 4th of July, we had a party for him in this neighborhood area. And at the party, someone mentioned that he was a Tai Chi master and asked if he would give a demonstration for us, our group. And he did at that party. And I chatted with him after that, and I said, you know, a lot of the things you're doing are very much like fly fishing. He said, what's fly fishing? I said, tomorrow I'll take you out to the stream and show you. And I got in my rubber boots, and I got my rod together, and I climbed in the stream, and I started fishing upstream. And he walked along the bank, and all of a sudden he said, no, I don't believe this. I don't believe this. He said, this is better than Tai Chi. He said, you're casting backwards and you're missing the trees. You're not putting your line in the grass. And I said, well, a fly fisherman has to think in 360 degrees. He said, that's better than Tai Chi. I have to take this back home with me and tell people fly fishing is better than Tai Chi. And I'll never forget the expression on his face when he found that out.
What a great story. Thanks for sharing that with us. Heidi Oberstadt and Dan Perkins are our guests today on Route 51 as we discuss fly fishing in Wisconsin and the magic it represents. Your questions for our guests are welcome. Join us by calling 800-780-9742. You can also email us at route51@wpr.org. I'm Shereen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
The way the sun bounced off the water, I could hardly make him out, but I could see he had a fish on, a big old rainbow trout. The fight went on forever, and as they headed down my way, I saw his military haircut and the new scars on his face. Right then I knew what brought him to this place. You know the river don't talk. The river
care where you've been, what you've done, or why it is you're standing there. It just rolls on by, whispering to your soul, it's gonna be alright. The river just knows.
Of course, now I'm too old to be much of a fisherman. And now I usually fish the big waters alone, although some friends think I shouldn't. But when I am alone in the half-light of the canyon, all existence seems to fade to a being with my soul and memories, and the sounds of the Big Blackfoot River and a four-count rhythm, and the hope that a fish will rise. Eventually, all things merge into one, and a river runs through it. The river was cut by the world's great flood and runs over rocks from the basement of time. On some of the rocks are timeless raindrops. Under the rocks are the words. And some of the words are theirs. I am haunted by waters.
We're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. That was a clip from Norman MacLean's 1992 film, A River Runs Through It, an autobiographical story that centered on one family's love of fly fishing. We continue our discussion now on the magical art of fly fishing with our guests, Dan Perkins and Heidi Oberstadt. We'd like to hear about your fly fishing experiences, and your questions are welcome too. Email us at route51@wpr.org or join us by phone at 800-780-9742. I loved that movie because it really gave a voice to the magic that happens among families and friends who share this passion for fly fishing. And it's such a solitary activity, but it can also really connect people to one another who share that passion for it. And Dan, you mentioned that earlier about how connected your family is because of their fly fishing experience. Do you also share secrets with friends? Do you have a group of friends who also enjoy fly fishing? Is that something that connects you with them?
Yes, indeed. Most of the people that I still hang around with at our old age do like fly fishing. And all of them, when I told them about the possibility of this particular hour we're spending together, all had advice. And in each case of five different people, it was a different reason. They said, what are you going to do? I said, I think we're going to talk about why people fly fish. And they each wanted to tell me their story, why they fly fished. And each of their stories were different. And each of these five people I've known for 50 or 60 or more years, but there are some things I didn't know about them. And that was the why they're doing that. And that's just another example. We're not at all alike in our reasoning. But when we want to go fishing, we want to go with each other because we're sharing that understanding of the joy of the moment that was just described in the film narration. What happens when you're in that solitary mode by yourself on the stream? And as Heidi already indicated, you make that one perfect cast and that fish takes it in. There have been times when I've gone fishing and I make two or three casts, and the fish takes it, and I miss catching them, and I go home. I've been known to go drive 20 minutes out here to Elk Creek and fish for 20 minutes and then come home because I just wanted to see the fish take a fly. And that seems to me to be the common factor, the mythology that's in each of us somehow. And in this real primitive circumstance of trying to catch a critter, for what reason? different reasons, but all people are willing to share. And I've never heard anybody say, that's a stupid reason to go fly fishing. People who fly fish don't complain about each other's reasons for doing it. Share the fact that we are doing it.
So when it comes right down to it, Dan, why do you fly fish?
Well, I do it a lot now for memory. That is, to conjure memories. Last week I was fishing and I did a horrible back cast and my fly got caught in the tree. And I went back there and I climbed up the bank and I leaned over and I grabbed a branch and I'm pulling this branch down and I'm trying to get this fly back out of there again. And all of a sudden, the voice of my father, who died in 1984, said, "What are you doing in that tree, boy?" And I looked around. This, my dad's voice as clear as possible, and he was chuckling because here I was trying to get a 39-cent fly out of a tree instead of just breaking it off and leaving. That is a whole lifetime. You asked me when I caught my first fish. I remember that first little trout I caught on a worm under the culvert. That was probably back in 1949 or 1950. The memories are why I go back, because I keep adding to those memories.
Heidi, what about you? Why do you fly fish? I know why you started. We talked about that earlier. But why do you fish now?
When I fly fish, I feel like I'm connected to something. I feel like I'm a part of something bigger. You know, I said how I got into fly fishing, and it didn't have anything to do with my family. But it turns out that my grandfather was an avid fly angler. And he lost his hearing after working in factories for many years without hearing protection. And it was hard to connect with him in his later years. But when he realized that I was getting into fly fishing, he would put in his hearing aids and we would talk. And it was really something that felt like we could be connected. I feel like I'm connected with all those fish in there, with all the people who have done all the work to restore those streams over the years, with everyone who's fished there before. It really feels like you're a part of something bigger. And it is the best anxiety reliever on the planet. I mean, you can't be in a stream like that and be stressed. When I leave, I'm a better version of myself.
And Heidi, you work for Trout Unlimited. So tell us a little bit more about the organization. What do the chapters do? What's the role?
Sure. So I should know, I volunteer with Trout Unlimited. I'm the Wisconsin Trout Unlimited's Diversity Initiative Chair. And then I'm the Midwestern Ambassador for TU's National Diversity Initiative. And in Wisconsin TU, we have over 6,500 members. And what we do is we volunteer. In a typical year, we volunteer over 50,000 hours, working to ensure that future generations have access to cold, clean, fishable water. And so that involves everything from education to teaching children about fish. We have Trout in the Classroom projects, where we work with school teachers to get children learning about the trout life cycle and how important they are in an ecosystem, to raising money and doing manpower hours on stream restoration projects, doing cool projects like Stream Girls, which is a collaboration between Trout Unlimited and Girl Scouts of America to get girls on the water and help them earn those fishing badges, while simultaneously learning about stream health and riparian vegetation. You know, I feel like this is a great theme between Dan and I, that this is, it's all in one project. You know, when you go fly fishing, it's not just you, it's the fish, it's the water, it's the grasses, it's the trees, it's we're all connected. And Trout Unlimited works to make sure that everybody stays connected and that future generations have the same opportunities that we do.
Thank you. Dan, I wanted to get back to some of the technique issues around fly fishing. And is there a specific time that's better to fish, or doesn't it matter?
I didn't hear part of that question. It dropped out.
I'm sorry. I was asking what time of day is the best time to fish for trout. Is there a specific time that's better than others, in darkness, in light?
My understanding from chatting with ichthyologists about this, brown trout tend to be somewhat more nocturnal. And I learned that from my father. So usually when I go fishing, if I were going to go fishing today, I'd probably go out about 7:30 this evening, because the streams near me are brown trout streams. Brook trout seem to be easy to catch almost any time during the course of the day, especially if there's a hatch of flies on. But if that changes, say it gets 4 or 5 degrees cooler tonight, about 6:30 or 7 o'clock, and that hatch dies off, the brook trout they probably will quit. But that's just trout. I think it's really important to indicate you can fly fish for any kind of fish that you want. Bass, bluegills, perch, crappies, go to the ocean and catch a tarpon. Fly fishing for all of those fish is possible. But a number of people have commented on the question you asked, and they simply said there's only two times to go fishing, when it's raining and when it's not raining.
I love that. What about the best time of year to fish for trout? Heidi, what's the best time of year to do that?
So if you fly fish in the winter, you're crazy, but it's still fun. We do it. The water freezes on your lines and your guides and everything. Spring and fall are wonderful. As I mentioned earlier, that cold water temperature is really important for trout. So I actually have a little thermometer that I take with me, you know, as it gets into the warmer months of the year, to make sure that the water temperature isn't too high, because I do catch and release fishing. And so I give the trout back. And if I want them to go back in the water and I want them to live, I can't tax them too hard. And warm water is kind of a key part of that. So once the water gets above 65, 66 degrees, I go fishing for smallmouth instead.
Okay. And so you do catch and release. Dan, what about you? Do you keep what you catch?
No, my research is coming from different directions than I found from TU. And any stress on the fish I find is damaging. One of the things we've got in some smaller streams over here is please take 5 fish of any size, because all the catch and release has put so many fish back in that the streams are overstocked. And we're now in a case where our you know, it used to be 5 system classifications, now down to 3. And in one of those 3, it says, please take 5 fish. Well, we've done so much catch and release that we're doing some harm in a way to the streams by packing in too many small fish. So I take them home. They're edible. And once I've stressed them on a stream, if they're a keepable fish, they go in my fry pan or in my freezer.
One final question. We've got about a minute left. I have to say, when I was growing up, fly fishing was kind of the sport that my friend's executive grandfather would do. You know, they'd fly to Alaska, take this puddle jumper to some remote location and fish by day and commiserate in a lodge by night. Now it can certainly be still that at times, but it feels like the landscape of the sport has changed a bit. It's more of a young, diverse culture than it used to be. Heidi, are you finding that there are more women on the water or working as fly guides now compared to years ago?
Absolutely. I can't speak to more than 10 years ago before I was involved in the industry, but in the 2016 Recreational Boating and Fishing Survey, they said that over 34% of freshwater anglers are women, and more are getting into fly fishing as it becomes more accessible. That's part of what I work for in the Diversity Initiative, is making fly fishing and Trout Unlimited more welcoming to people of all diverse areas.
And I mean, do you think that's really the wave of the future, that more people are going to be enjoying it in the future?
Yes. I know that we're getting to the end of the time here, but I think it's noteworthy that women have been fly fishing for a very long time. Carrie Frost was from Stevens Point, and she opened her own fly tackle business in 1896. So she has been rocking it here for many, many years.
That's all we have time for today on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. I'd like to thank our guest, Heidi Oberstad of Trout Unlimited, and former UWO Professor Dan Perkins. Our producer is Joy Ratch-Kramer. Our executive producer is Rick Ryer, who is also our on-air producer today. Special music today from Horseshoes and Hand Grenades, Ella Fitzgerald, Rodney Atkins, and Daryl Worley. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. You can hear the archive of today's program at wpr.org/route51. Next week, tune in for a discussion on farmers markets and the local food landscape in north central Wisconsin. And in 2 weeks, a legislative roundup with 2 representatives from the Wisconsin State Legislature. Until then, we're heading out of town.
But I'll take down your fishing pole and meet me at the fishing hole. We may not get about all day, but don't you rush away. What a great place to rest your bones, and mighty fine for skipping stones. You feel fresh as a lemonade for sitting in the shade. Whether it's hot, whether it's cool, oh, what a spot for whistling like a fool. What a fine